The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Afternoon. Well, I'm here today to talk to you about Story Wars, because that sounded dramatic. Summary here in your little booklets is stated this way. All too often, worldview lessons are abstract, remaining in the intellect and never truly reaching and affecting the lives of students. Stories, however, are the hands that shape the spinning clay. More, they provide the potter's wheel and pump it up to speed. They make us who we are. Which narratives, ancient and modern, really shape your students' aspirations, identities, and loyalties? How can you, as a teacher, learn to control the process? And I've seen, I haven't done a lot of teaching on the secondary level or younger, but I'm pushing 10 years now working with freshmen at New St. Andrews College, and those freshmen have been over 10 years sampled out of a lot of different educational experiences. So some of them are homeschooled, some of them come from a lot of tutorial background, co-ops, public school, private classical school, you know, just generic church school, a lot of different types. And so as I talk about this, I'm talking about it from that perspective, from what I see when I receive 18-year-olds. You know, they show up done with whatever it is that's been provided to them from the ACCS or ACSI or homeschool. Wherever they come from, I get them then, when the secondary teacher's job is done. And so I'm in a position, whether objectively or subjectively, to judge your work. Luckily, I don't have to judge my work. I get to look at these kids, and I honestly don't get to see parents very often. You know, and I see two different kids from the same school, and they might have the same problems, and I start to detect some kind of pattern and so on. But honestly, even though there's a lot of variation between flavors of faults in kids and flavors of strengths in kids, all of them, from all different educational backgrounds, share weaknesses here. They all have vulnerabilities here in this area. And that's something that's been almost universal. The problem, or problemos. Anyone with any teaching experience has seen students who are intelligent, and intelligent enough to grasp all the material, everything, anything you write on the board, even all the worldview, philosophical, theological material. It doesn't matter how intense it is, how abstract it is, they got it. You grade their little multiple choice test and you say, wow, Betsy is sharp. Why is she dating a Mormon? Or something like that. When it comes to their own lives, they are mere finger puppets for the latest trend, style, music, film, whatnot. And I don't care which trend, style, music. It could be contemporary Christian music, but they're in it as a trend, as a style, as a fad. You know, they're in it in a cliquish way, or they're into whatever super special Christian punk. I've encountered a couple of those, really into Christian punk bands. Top of the list of my favorites right there. It doesn't matter. Or they could be just diehard Eastern European film fans. Also encountered those. They could be all about being the most elite, knowing about the bands nobody else knows about, the ones that haven't even been formed yet. The movies that still aren't even in subtitle, but they've watched multiple times because they are studying to be a great director. Or whatever, you know, and it's some bizarre Swedish story that always involves incest. So that's what Swedish stories do. So it does, I'm not saying, when I say trend, style, fad, I'm not talking about secular. I'm talking about any kind of aesthetic commitment that is based on trend, style, or fad. So they've picked a clique. They've gone this direction. It's all CCM. And that's it. But why are they there? Is it thoughtful? Is it understanding? They're there because they've sort of picked a team. and other people drift the other direction, and they're off with the secular elitists, primarily so they don't have to be over there with those people with the Christian music. But the motivation to be where they are is not intellectual. It's not intelligent at all. It's a narrative decision. They've made a decision based on who they want to be, the character they want to be, the person they want to be, and so on. Why do smart kids frequently have no cultural immune system whatsoever, no matter how often you tell them that they should? And some people will say, well, you know, a private school kid will have a little more sophistication than a homeschool kid, and to some extent, that's true. But I see a lot of private school kids who come in with basically a low grade fever. You know, they've been influenced. They have a lot. There's some damage there. There's things they love. They love passionately. They have deep loyalty to. And it doesn't matter if we sit down and have a conversation where they admit that it's driven by a God-hating philosophy. They still have affection and loyalty to it. And then you have a really great little intelligent homeschool kid who has no low-grade fever, because they've never resisted any kind of virus whatsoever. They just haven't seen one. The last film they saw was called Shenandoah. They come in and they do things like ask to borrow somebody else's entire music collection. Then you ask why, and they say, because I want to find out what kind of music I like. You know, they don't know. So some would say tabula rasa, blank slate. Honestly, it's like you've grown some sort of plant outside of the wind. You've kept a little shell around it. You got the tomato plant really tall. Then now, congratulations, go forth and thrive in the great wide atmosphere. And they blow right over. They show up to my office and say something about Hellboy 2. And they say, that was amazing. And, you know, a hipster can like that and be ironic, and, you know, there's all sorts of layers there that are okay for cool kids, but this kid's not cool. This kid is in there saying, mind blown. I didn't know this stuff existed. This has changed my world. And it has. It really did change their world. They don't even know how to begin to process this. Like, no concept whatsoever. So on one hand, you have basic resistance to narratives. So exterior narratives, stories, films, especially films now. How do you actually train students to process this, engage? How do you do it in a sloppy area that doesn't have objective, nailed down answers? How do you do that? And I think that's the problem. The problem is kids who come out vulnerable out of your schools, out of your homeschools, which just means your home, kids who are vulnerable to the assaults of the world, that's the problem. Why aren't they dangerous? And why aren't they dangerous to the world? And to really, really increase the problem here, why is it that most of the most effective God-hating atheists, anti-Christian, you know, leaders came up in Christian families, came up in Christian education? It's like, how is that possible? It's like, well, because you make them really, really, really smart and easy to recruit. And that's it. So they're sharp. They understand Western tradition. They understand Western lit. They're ready to be used. Then they are corrupted quickly. Those are the more successful ones. So some people just fall over, get crushed. Others get recruited because they're talented, because they had a great education. And then you end up staffing the opposing army. And you go through the list. I don't care if you go back to Nietzsche and look at who his dad was and what his thinking spawned. You know, how did he come out of a pastor's family and so on? But there's a long tradition of Christians training up God-haters, and the most effective God-haters, those communicators who go on to rattle the faith of other little Christian kids and then lead them into the culture war, but on the wrong side. So there's your problem. How do you even begin to try to fix it? The discussion of intellect versus wisdom. There's a difference between knowing and knowing, which is to say that there's a difference between hearing and repeating to you on a test and possessing. How do you get your students to possess this stuff, this not just information, but this paradigm, this worldview? How do you make it theirs, not yours, which they tell, you know, they repeat back to you for an A? How do you make it theirs? How do you shape their own mental skeleton? Data knowledge versus bone knowledge. Everybody knows what it's like to have a kid who can tell you that's wrong. Yeah, you shouldn't do that. It's kind of stupid. I know what your position is here. And then for some reason, they're doing it. You know, for some reason, they keep slipping into that sin. A lot of people know that firsthand, what it's like to say, okay, this is a problem. I should not do this. Oops, why am I doing this? Here I am again. Here I am again. Here I am again. And it's a certain kind of narrative innocence, you know, in the wrong sense of the word. A narrative naivete, that you know this intellectually. You can say this like a computer could say it. But when it comes to living it, you can't actually govern yourself as a character in a narrative. You can't actually choose between this path and that path. You can't actually say, this makes me a really pompous ass, and this makes me humble. You could if you read the story in a book. If somebody, a Tom Wolfe, for example, grabbed you and sketched you ruthlessly. You know, any given scene, you are up in front of a classroom full of eighth graders, talking to them. And you have Tom Wolfe sit there, omniscient, able to analyze and shred in prose who you are as a character. You know, it'd be appalling, be horrifying to read that, and, you know, it also would be true of everybody. It's like we're all fallen. We're all weak. We all have insecurities. We all have things that an omniscient narrator could pick to shreds. But we all pretend like we don't. And we all throw a facade up, and we refuse to live as a character. And honestly, getting your students to learn how to live with narrative wisdom begins with you as teachers, as parents, learning the same lesson. And it starts with knowing that there's a big, big difference between data knowledge and bone knowledge, knowing something innately and knowing something mentally. The mind is a sticky place. Treat it like a hard drive, especially when kids are small. Say something often enough, and kids will be able to repeat it to you. Big deal. So what? You know, that there's your grammar phase. Congratulations, they can say things. What are they going to do with it? And that's a great phase. I'm not belittling that. Don't stop there. You say it over and over and over again. You make them memorize the Proverbs. That's great. That's an asset to them. But you need to flesh those things out. They need to make those stories, those warnings, their own. How do you get kids who can see and read the world? They can read their own behavior, the behavior of those around them, and even the movements of nations and cultures. Who wants a bunch of smart fools? The story wars. Well, the world is telling one story. Every book you introduce in a classroom is telling a story. A Christian story, partially Christian story, heretical story, orthodox story, flat-out secular story. They're all telling stories. Philosophers are telling stories. And usually philosophers are giving you more an idea for a story. So they're not actually spinning the narrative. They're setting it up, saying, okay, so here's the way it works. And they're all weird little pulp fantasy authors pitching a publisher their concept. So in my world, this is what morality is based on. And our hero, me, always, the philosopher says, behaves this way. And they start doing this. Kant does this. Hume does this. Nietzsche does this. They all give ideas for a story, for a world. And they postulate them and then try to replace this world with it. A lot of other people come in telling their stories, Homer, for example, and tells you that the world is a certain type of place. Now, he reflects his vision of the world. Here it is. And if you have boys and you think, oh, good, I'll get them excited about classical education, let's get really, really into the Iliad, shall we? Let's get really excited about blood and gore. Let's throw ourselves into that. Let's all love Achilles. It's like, well, if you have students who love Achilles after reading the Iliad, congratulations, you've tainted them. You've made them, at best, hollow-chested little putzes who wish they could be great big putzes. And at worst, actually masculine, aggressive destroyers of communities around them. Like that becomes their idol. A lot of classical educators think classics, goody. We want them to love the classics. It's like, no, you don't want them to love the classics. You want them to process the classics. You want them to pull things out of the classics which they ought to love, which are honorable. And you want them to pull things out of the classics which they'd like to throw on a pyre and burn in classic pagan fashion. That's what you want them to do. You want them to hate Agamemnon and Achilles. You want them to have a major problem with Odysseus' whole stint on that island with that darn nymph. Nymphs are always trouble. That's one of the things they should take away from your schools. So don't just think that we're up against Hollywood. You're up against every book you hand them. Every book you give them to read is in part an enemy. It's like you're bringing little miniature enemies in, you set them on the desk, and you will hopefully show them how to sort, process, defeat, and then eventually, ideally, enslave this thing. Make this thing theirs. Make it behave the way they want it to behave. Be able to use its strengths and throw out its weaknesses. Is Dante their friend? Should he be? Like, which parts are great, which parts aren't? So, pop culture is the current threat. But I've seen just as many classical educators damage their good little SCL students with the classics as I've seen their bad little C students get damaged by film, especially edgy film. So don't think that just because it's old and dusty, we're just fine. We're golden. And honestly, if you teach a girl to love The Highwayman or Romeo and Juliet, then you are just prepping her for the lies of Twilight. There you go. The Highwayman came riding. Did he? Like, it's just... It's complete crap. Romeo and Juliet, same thing. What on earth? I mean, are both of these characters, how many morons are there in this play? And you work through it, and you should show them how to shred Shakespeare. Obviously, where were Shakespeare's personal weaknesses? It's like, was he a wonderful character with no faults, or did some of those faults manifest themselves in this particular story? So if you take your good little voracious vacuum cleaner reader and you say, yes, that's a dangerous romantic poem, but you give it to her anyway, isn't it exciting to see her read? And she starts wishing she could be Bess, the landlord's daughter. It just doesn't work out in the end. Eventually, she's reading Mormon teen vampire fiction, and otherwise known as a manual for how to become an abused woman. And you've prepped her for that. So rather than actually helping defend this girl, giving her tools to defend herself, you actually opened the breach. It's like you actually said, here, let's start with the ancient versions of this particular egregious fault, and then we'll work up to the contemporary ones. And boys, it's just as easy. It's like you give them things. I've seen papers from kids talking about the glories of revenge. You know, how great revenge is. You think, what? Where's this coming from? And they're citing left and right from the ancients. It's like the satisfaction of justice when you finally get to really just take that guy's head off and then make a cup out of the top of his skull. And you think, okay, so we were missing some other components here. We read scripture and we read Homer and we sort of threw them all together and made some terrible little stew. You have got to go after narratives. You've got to go after every narrative. You do not ever set anything down on a desk for kids and say, this is a great work of literature. We will all sit at its knee and learn. So, yeah, this is a great work. This has influenced Western culture. Should it have? You know, has it influenced it to the good? You know, what stuff here is terrible? What stuff is great? And that should be true of every single book. I don't care if it's My Side of the Mountain or Where the Red Fern Grows. I don't care how old they are. You've got to introduce the concept of being able to hate something. They must know how to hate. Not just learn, not just love. They have to know how to hate. And my kids are quite young right now. We already worked through this. So if we go watch How to Train Your Dragon or something like that, then they don't get to just ooh and ah. And gargle its message. What was good about it? What was bad about it? What would you change about it? Put yourself in a position of leadership over what you read. If you were Milton, what would you have done? If you were DreamWorks, what would you have done? How would you have improved it? Where does it stink? Where could it be improved? And we're still all just at the aesthetic level. We're not yet getting to the moral lifestyle issues that leave characters vulnerable. Characters meaning your students when they actually live their own stories. My daughter, who is a complete piglet for stories, all my kids are, but she really, really loves them. It took one book read to her in the school library for her to come home and say, I think the next day, what's wrong with that? I'm just following my dreams. And I say, hello? You know, so we're like, okay, let's discuss this, shall we? Let's work through it. Which book was this? You know, and you have an innocuous little, you know, virtually like Mickey Mouse and the Magic Grinder level book. And it's all about, you know, dreaming about who you can become and just being that and chasing your dreams. It doesn't matter what anybody says. Just leave it behind. And of course, immediately after that, I told my wife, it's like, we are not watching The Little Mermaid. Not for a while. And not that I have a problem watching The Little Mermaid. The question is, I don't want her to watch it until she actually can dismiss it, until she knows which things to keep, which things to think are funny, and which things to brush off. Because you're not just teaching them that if they ever encounter a giant, witchy octopus, that she's the bad person and you should never sign a contract with that woman. That's not the only lesson there. There's also a whole father-daughter thing going on, which is actually what is really being preached there. Prophets and guides, heroes and villains. Wisdom comes with age, hopefully. It doesn't always. But we are not isolated units. Cultural wisdom, cultural vision is collected from many lives and it is handed down in story. Equip your students. The right narratives, read in the right way, are a tool, a protection, and a danger to fools. But in order to do this, you have to have discernment yourself as an instructor, as a teacher, and you have to be willing, as I was saying yesterday in my workshop, you have to be willing to get into really painful conversations with students and teachers. You have to be willing to do that. The reason why they're painful conversations is because some of these girls are reading Twilight with their dad, who also cried. Now what? Well, your dad has problems, kid. And then you're going to go have a meeting with the administrator, right? We're going to have a powwow. I would just say have these discussions over email so there's a paper trail. It's a good thing to do. You can actually point out what you really said. But at the same time, you cannot be afraid to go there. You cannot be afraid to go into that area in the classroom and say, this is bad, this is good. That's your job. That's what you're supposed to be doing. It's your job. And if a parent disagrees with you, well, obviously, they can undermine you with the student. That's fine. It's their kid. They can say, don't listen to her. You know, she just doesn't understand, says the weepy-eyed father. She's never really understood the appeal of a golden-eyed vampire. Have the fight. Go ahead, have the fight. You should have a New Year's resolution, and this is the kind of thing I'm going to get in trouble for saying, of just be willing to have more fights. And we'll get into the character living, which means you should also be the good guy in those fights. Not the bad guy, not the overreaching teacher. But you should be willing to say, this is good, and here's why. This is bad, and here's why. And you'll have a major reaction, and the reason why is because we have left that wall in our city completely down. So your kids are really good at math, really good at logic, for the most part. They get really good at Latin. You know, you can do this whole thing, and you just leave that wall unbuilt. Why? Because people are attacking there. There's all sorts of activity. We'll have disagreements. Rocks will be thrown. Pointy objects will be run with. It's going to be dangerous. So let's just ignore it. Let's have a policy in our school that says teachers can't actually address these issues. Which means we would just like to drop them all in my lap or college professor's lap or somebody else's lap and let them become whatever it is they're going to become. It's like we're just going to leave them off, you know, completely vulnerable there to go get morphed by whatever narratives they choose to be affected by. Cultural wisdom is collected from many lives. One of the best ways that you can actually teach your students wisdom is by giving them the right stories. This enables them to make very big mistakes in fiction. But the right stories mean the right things happen after those mistakes. And this isn't just moralistic. This is a question of realism. So a lot of people will, you know, come back at me and say, well, there's so many great works that would disagree with this, and surely there are outcomes that vary. No, this is, it's not like that. This is like moral gravity. God has made the world in such a way that when you are proud, what happens? It's like we're told what happens. When you commit adultery, what happens? If you go after that seductress, what happens? What occurs? God tells this story, and there are patterns. He's the author telling us, be sure your sin will find you out. And the reason why is because he'll make sure it does. He's writing. He's writing the story, and he's saying, if you do that on page 5, I'm going to hammer you on 12. It's like, I'm going to rain the sky down. And we all know what that's like. A good story always starts with some kind of fall. You know, a character who's human, not perfect, human, like these kids. A character who falls. A character who actually reaps the whirlwind as a result of that fall, and then comes out the other end. You want to actually equip your girls for Twilight? They should be reading Anna Karenina. It's like, do I have a problem with a dark story with adultery in it? No, of course not, because the right things happen. What happens in the Old Testament? They should love those stories. They should claim those stories as their own. Read them, and they'll learn to flinch like characters who have already touched that fire. It's like they can actually get from data knowledge to bone knowledge, because they have connected with the character. They've empathized and sympathized with someone. They have ridden somebody else's fall all the way down, and they have seen it. They've seen what it's like. Give them the wrong stories, and they'll read about somebody's fall, and they say, man, if I did that too, I would be such a good poet. Because he was, right? It's like, well, man, Coleridge, really, whew, he was great. Or Byron, Kelly. There's lots and lots of horrible, horrible stories there that get glamorized. The myth of the tortured artist, the person who cuts their own ear off, destroys their life and the lives of every potential spouse they've ever met. But luckily, they were a great, great man. It's like, so we tell them that lie. And a lot of teachers bring in all this biographical data, and they share it all, and they make it, it's glamorous. Like, yeah, he swallowed a shotgun in the end, but woo, wow, that guy lived first. And I've been there. I've been in the situation where I'm sitting there with the lame story with a group of students. I was a lot younger than them. I was with my sisters. And it was a Christian camp in Colorado, and the leader, the instructor, went around and said, tell us how you know you're a Christian. You know, let's talk about assurance of salvation, conversion, that kind of thing. And we get to my older sister, and she says, well, I don't remember my conversion. I was very, very small. I think she was 3-ish, 2 or 3, really young. And then it was my turn. It's like, well, I don't remember either. I said I would hold out till I was 6, but I didn't make it. And my little sister's kind of, don't know. We're all just here. And then the teacher goes around, and it's like, well, I was smoking a lot of pot, getting into a lot of trouble, stealing stuff, shoplifting, got busted. My youth pastor, I got thrown out of my parents' house. My youth pastor took me in. And there's all these stories. And then the blinding light on the Damascus Road, that whole thing. And we still know that this person's still sneaking around out back smoking and not necessarily tobacco. But the instructor says, what do you all think of these kids who think they're Christians, who don't have any kind of narrative for that? It's like that, and I, at that point, I didn't understand fully the full narrative for it. Do you think that they, and they all democratically decided that we actually weren't. So I also, in a graduate school classroom, had everybody democratically decide that the whole Henry V incident was not part of the 100 Years' War. Professor, everybody voted. Instead of looking it up, but anyway, it's a different story. So we're sitting there without a narrative for ourselves. And we actually, had one. We were being taught one and growing up into one, but we were honestly at least secure enough to think that they were all morons. so I can, you know, to survive the instant that way. But the truth is, as you teach your kids, the question is, where are their heroes? What narrative do they belong to? So not just, this is what this book says, this is what this book says, what does this guy say, it's false, this guy says something that's true. Who are they? Who are your students? Where do they fit in this story? Which team are they on? Where are their loyalties? And you have to be able to tell the entire story. There's one story with one major team division, and it starts in a garden, and it ends in a garden, and there's a lot of action in between. Where do they fit? Where do these kids fit? Where are their loyalties? And every time you start seeing them have loyalties across the chasm, you should get really, really worried. It's like the problem isn't that, well, you know, that song is a little bit sexual. The problem is that you can see loyalties begin to drift toward the other team's uniform, the other team's theme song. I really like their band. It's like, I like the way they all march and dance. I really like that over there. I want to be a writer. If I want to be a writer, I need to be full of angst. You know, I need to be kind of pimply and have a substance abuse problem in order to be a great writer, because that's what we're told. Kerouac did what? How did he do it? It's like, well, you know, he taped all the pieces of paper together and stuck it into his typewriter and wrote the entirety of his, you know, of one of his novels just on one continuous sheet while strung out constantly on liquor, cigarettes, and just would pass out and come to and keep writing. And that's, in a lot of places, that's glamorized. You know, the writer's life is a tortured one. And they're hardcore. It's like, those guys are hardcore. It's like, but you know, honestly, the prophet's life was much worse and much crazier. Go nude for a while. Cook with human dung. Let's do that. Get fed by birds. And so on. It's like there are counterpoints. It's like there are major counterpoints. It's like if you have students who are attracted to the hard life, to major obstacles, there are plenty of people that they can relate to, plenty of people they can idolize who did it for the right reasons and in the right way. Now this is where it kind of gets a little bit scary, at least I think it does, because if you want to communicate to the students where they fit in the narrative, the starting point is where you fit in the narrative. And it doesn't matter what you tell them. I'm a good guy. I'm on the good team. And they're sitting there thinking, yeah, but you totally blow up at us all the time. You completely favor that little blonde bubblehead over there. I don't know why. But you don't grade me seriously. And do you think that they're shaping their loyalties with that? How do they view the school? Primarily anal, you know, anal retentive academy? Is that what we are? We're team stress out about skirt length? That's our team? We're team polyester? Like, you know, how do you handle it? And I've got no problem with school uniforms. I appreciate the fact that my kids are all in them. You know, it's great. But how is it pitched? How is it presented? How is it enforced? What's the style? What's the personality? And so on. Every one of those things, every discipline issue, every time you correct somebody in the classroom, you're telling the story. It's like, I'm the guy up front with the chalk, so shut up. Don't question me. It's like, how does that play out in a film? It's like, the kids read enough, they watch enough films, they know what happens to that guy. Right? Do they want to be on that guy's team? No, they don't. And so they create a gulf. They create miniature gulfs, oppositions, competitions. Everything's a story. So you become either a mentor, that gatekeeper, guardian, sage, you know, character that's through all Western literature, or you become that guy, the fool, the old fool who thinks he's in charge, the guy who thinks he knows better. And then you have an insurrection on your hands, and you wonder why your students become more loyal to any kind of external authority. You create that gulf between your students and yourself, and right now you're a representative of that school. And that school is a representative of what? Parental authority, Christendom, and so on. And all you're doing is driving a small wedge. It's really, really fine, but you're driving a wedge. You want to teach them which characters they are, Show them what character you are. And you cannot tell them. This is not data transfer. We're not talking about data knowledge. We're not even talking about intellect here, although there's slop. We're talking about absolute bone knowledge, instinct, narrative living. Who are you? And who are you as answered by that scary Tom Wolfe author in the corner? You know, you're the guy who always clears his throat when he's challenged and then kind of flexes his shoulders to try to scare the poor girl, try to look a little bigger or something like that. Or the guy who quickly turns around, or the guy who actually says he knows something when he doesn't. The guy who says, oh yeah, I read it, and that guy doesn't understand, but you haven't read it. The guy who prepared his lecture on Wikipedia, but the students don't know that. The author knows it. The author knows that. Which team are you really on? And you know, you know that. It's like, I'm on the good team. Sure. Are you that weak point in the line? It's like, are you that shepherd snoozing? Are you the one giving the kids the excuse to start shifting their loyalties elsewhere? And that's what it comes down to. So narrative, where they root their loyalties. Their loyalties should be to Samson, who led a very disastrous life, you know, in the end. But you should be able to finish that story for them with the resurrection. You know, as my kids are quick to point out, that Samson has eyes now. You can't end at the collapse. Where are their loyalties? To Elijah, to Moses, to Samson, to Martin Luther, Athanasius. There's a whole long narrative thread that runs all the way back. All these dragon slayers, giant killers, all these culture builders. And then there's a whole long line of the hypocrites, the counterfeits, the well-intentioned people who drove the kid away, and so on. It's like there's horrible stories, a lot of horrible stories that you can read about great atheists, great God-haters, and their early instances, their early issues with the church, and some guy who wouldn't let him into the congregation because he wasn't dressed appropriately, or something like that. There's a lot of stories that play out that way. There's a whole bunch of people hooking a whole bunch of millstones on a whole bunch of kids. And the millstones are frequently narrative millstones. You know, the people who say they represent Christ, God, Christendom, the faith, the true narrative, and then can't get beyond themselves. They're proud, they're arrogant, they refuse to admit when they're wrong, and so on. They dominate. They don't listen. And they're telling these kids all sorts of things about their team. This is the team you, kids, must show loyalty to. We are the good guys. And we all know how that plays out in the end. Some of them return by the grace of God, despite all that, stronger, having made the faith their own, through having gone and eaten a lot of pig food. They actually go off and they join philosophy clubs. They lead their strange little life and discover that they actually don't like scotch that much, at least not in that quantity. And they end up coming back. You know, Chesterton describes the return, running away from the faith and running around the world until he actually returned in the back door, rediscovering his native land. A lot of people are there. A lot of others are just left in simple hatred, apostasy, unbelief. And even a little short of them, people are simply vulnerable, which just means not dangerous. They might live faithfully. They might keep their loyalties to the church, but they live in fear. They're not a threat to the world. They're just a survivor of the world. And that's not what you want to be training up. You don't want to train kids who simply get through it. You know, they get their job. They keep their head down. They just don't listen to it because I don't know why it's so attractive to me. I'm not going to engage. I'm not going to watch that. You know, and they don't have the answers for their own kids. That's not a strong foundation for future generations. It doesn't really work that effectively. Who, when, what, where are these your students? The story is obviously the most important thing. How is the story told? In parcels? In versified bookmark portions? I really do, verse references are handy dandy, but I really do dislike verse markings as they are used when you're teaching kids, or as they're used in my own Bible reading. All these numbers, through it, just scattered through. They're great when we communicate to each other about exactly which part we're discussing, but honestly, give it to them like a novel. Give it to them like a history. Have them read through it like you have them read through Herodotus. It's a story. It has an arc. It has all these different characters that they should be learning about and from. And then you should be able to place them in that story. Place them in that narrative. You pick up immediately from where that leaves off, and you move into what? A different subject. We're not talking about the same thing now. You know, Roman history, the Holy Roman Empire, you know, on to the Reformation, those glorious Renaissance popes. You know, as we move through that trajectory, we're telling the same story. It's like this part we have inspired, this part we have access to, we don't have it inspired, but it's the same story. This is God still speaking. We're in Act 3 of Act 1. Like, so we've got all this thing, you know, this thing all broken out. We teach Bible class over here. Okay, we stopped. Now we're over here talking completely neutrally in an unintegrated way about something wholly other. What happens to Charlemagne? And should you have known what was going to happen based on what happened to Solomon? What happened to Byzantium? And should you have already known what was going to happen because you've read the earlier parts of the story and you know the loop, you know the pattern? You know how this goes. And then we talk about civics. And we say, the United States of America is wonderful. Fly the flag. Say the Pledge of Allegiance. We will never, ever go away. We are, after all, indivisible. Are we that stupid? What happened to Byzantium? What happened to Rome? What happened to Greece? What happened to everybody else who did the same stuff that we're doing now? And you look at the moment that these kids live in, the time that these kids live in, and it's connected to the narrative. So you can fit it right into place. And that tells them what, you know, which characters are they? Who are they? Do they have a completely, I'd say, a kingdom view of life? You know, where they have, well, I'm a Christian, but I'm going to go work hard to make some money, have a nice little living, get DirecTV, hopefully 2 flat screens, maybe a second receiver in the basement, have a man cave, it's going to be great. Is that their aspiration? You know, is it just, I live here in this great country where I can have lots of neat stuff? Man, I want the iPad. Is that it? Because I do want the iPad, incidentally. But you'll be proud of me for holding off thus far. iPhone 4 first. Is that what we are? Is that it? Or do we actually see the fact that here we are, once again, Christians in a bloated empire? When Augustine wrote City of God, explaining to the early Christians that Rome actually could fall and the church was going to be unaffected, that, you know, that was secondary, that was external, that was just artificial structure. That whole thing could come down around their ears and they shouldn't have their faith rattled. All of our red state Americans, the people that I like, the people with the right kind of mud flaps, all those people that I'm loyal to, in one sense, who claim the same faith that I have, how are they going to be affected? How would they be affected if the US of A rained down around their ears in the exact same place that the early Roman Christians were? Stunned, shocked. We can't be Christians and live in Canada. It can't happen. And we're here. This is the US, red, white, and blue. That's Christian. It's like it doesn't work that way. Teach them narratives. Start with the scriptural narratives. Start with the scriptural characters where you have absolutely objective positions. You know, things you can maintain. God blessed this. Absolutely. This was blessed. This was destroyed. This was judged. And you move on. Let them read a lot of fiction. Make them dice it. Make them resist it. Do not make them read fiction too early. Do not brag to your friends, we make our fourth graders read Moby Dick. And our fourth graders hate us for it. You know, bully for you. You successfully alienate all those angry little fourth graders. My son could technically read Moby Dick right now, and it would make him loathe reading. He would rather read about Wyatt Earp in very large font with pictures. And I'm thrilled about that. Tell them the story. Make them read fiction. Give them characters they ought to sympathize with. Let them feel the fire of the fall vicariously. Through King David, through Solomon, through Samson, through Ahab. It's like through all those great big mistakes. And then move on. And they let them learn that pattern, teach them that pattern, and move into the histories. As you read Thucydides, as you read Herodotus, as you read the histories, know that you're telling them stories. These are stories, not things to be outlined, although outlines can be helpful. They're stories to be understood, to be grasped, to be swallowed, stories to affect you, lessons to be learned, pride falling over and over and over again, the Tower of Babel rising over and over and over again. If you watch what we're trying to do with genetics right now, and you talk about that in the classroom, you should say, "Hey kids, what's going to happen next?" And everybody should say, "Judgment." Because that's what's happened every other time. Or repentance. Judgment or repentance. Confusion. A curse on the languages. A flood. A fall. A disaster. Something's going to knock it all over. The tide's going to come up and take our sandcastle away one more time. Or we're going to repent one more time. And this is the story. Kids, you grasp that. Kids, you come in knowing about the Old Testament the way they know about their grandparents. They're connected to it. They say things like, "Yeah, I'm Scottish," even though they've never been. You know, they have a connection to their heritage. You know, "I'm Jewish. My family's, you know, Eastern European, came over after the Holocaust." They know those things. You know, they should have a connectivity with that, and the connectivity should run all the way back through these narratives. And they should have a go team, rah-rah spirit about Frodo and Aragorn also. Because they're on the same team. They're with us. Those are our guys. It's like they really are. And they should say, "Yeah, too bad about that Harry Potter kid. Because he had promise." Like, no, and there's great stuff there. There's a lot of good stuff. But they shouldn't just say, "I liked it. I had an enjoyable sensation when I read the book, and so I have loyalty to it." You're allowed to have the enjoyable sensation when you read the book. And now let's talk about it. It's like, which parts are great? Which parts, you know, not so much? Which parts could you improve on? And the same thing's true with our own people, where we're extremely loyal. If you read The Great Divorce, if you read the Narnia Chronicles or the Space Trilogy, you should be able to ask them, "How could C.S. Lewis have done a better job?" And most teachers go, "What? No, wait. We don't want to admit that this is not in the canon. Could it have been improved? Is it okay for a kid in the back to say, "I don't like the way he always gives away the fact that the kids make it out in the end"? You know, when something tense is happening and he says, "Lucy would look back on this as an old woman and remember." And is that a legitimate point? Sure. It's a stylistic one. It's a fad point. You know, we don't like that. We wouldn't like that in a film if, you know, somebody's about to get their head cut off and then we flash forward to them as a great-grandparent telling their kids, "But don't worry." You know, we want to actually experience the whole thing. Can you say that Out of the Silent Planet is weaker? And here's why. Then Perelandra. Yeah, he's on our team, but yes, you must say that because it's true and he knew it. He talks about it. It's like you have to be able to look at those things and say this could be refined. Ultimately, he achieved in that hideous strength. You know, ultimately, this is where he really hit his game. And let's look. Incidentally, this reminds me of the situation we're in right now as the United States of America. Let them claim their team and be on their team. Be that person who is on their team, the person in literature that is that friendly, older, wise mentor character. Not the know-it-all, proud, threatened, insecure character who teaches them to mistrust this little school, to mistrust their teachers, and so on. Teach them who they are. "We will judge angels," surely Napoleon, Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Samson, Moses, surely they aren't out of bounds. And we are really, really prone to sort of leave moral judgment until later. This kid's in first grade. Should we really, you know, talk about the hypocrisies of our own political leaders, the, you know, early foundation? Should we talk about Woodrow Wilson's problems or Abraham Lincoln's problems? Should we do that? Because that's going to create awkward conversations with neighbors when they get home. It's going to be interesting. And it will. It honestly will. It'll be like my parents explained to us that they spanked us because they loved us. It'll have the same effect that that did when my little sister told the neighbor girl that your parents must not love you. Santa Claus isn't real. Abraham Lincoln wanted to load the slaves up and ship them all back to Africa, and did successfully with a lot of them. It's like it didn't all work out. There's hypocrisies and flaws, power grabs. He threw the Maryland state legislature all in jail because they might have a vote on secession and kept them locked up. Or do we just say, President's Day, let's all cut out a profile of Abe Lincoln. Would you guys like to wear a beaver hat? Let's do that. And then later on they say, what? This was complicated? There were narrative intricacies here? What's going on? I was taught to be naive. I was taught to just think that characters were perfect. My picture Bible doesn't have that in there about Samson. You can't be like that as educators. You cannot be like that. You have to be honest. And you have to have students growing up knowing that you are, above all, honest with the story. Honest about, this guy was great, he was a hero, but he fell. What happened before St. George killed the dragon? He ran off with Duessa. And there's a great Caldecott-winning picture book of St. George and the Dragon that I really enjoy reading to my kids. But it sort of misses that whole business. You know, he just rides off with Una and he fights the dragon and he falls down 3 times. But luckily there's an apple tree and there's water and he comes back and he kills the dragon. But first he abandons Una and runs off with Duessa, the seductress, the witch with the false presentation. He is seduced and led astray. He falls. His armor rusts. And then he repents, he is forgiven, he comes back to Una, then he slays the dragon. Book 2 of the Faery Queen. You know, it's the same deal. The Bower of Bliss, it's actually that hideous strength. C.S. Lewis uses it. The Bower of Bliss, knowledge. And yes, lesbianism. And a lot of other things going on there in the Faery Queen. And Sir Gaion goes to rescue a whole bunch of knights who've been seduced by this, who've dropped out of their own obligations and left their faith. And then he restores them and destroys the Bower. And now, you don't want to introduce that story a little, you know, too early, sure. I understand that. But good luck reading Book 2 of the Faery Queen and not actually talking about political action in our current country. What do you do as characters? How do you handle immorality in those around you, in your brothers, in your sisters? What do you do? How active are you? How aggressive are you as a character? And the reason why these topics will come up, because kids read the story and they connect with a character. They just connected with a character who killed a whole bunch of people and chopped up this weird, seductive Bower of Bliss. Destroyed it, ruined it. College professors everywhere talk about this terrible puritanical outburst that Spencer had. He said the Bower was the really only beautiful thing in Spencer's poetry, and then he ruined it. And they do actually talk about that. The various commentators hate it. Hate the fact that Sir Gaion destroys this lovely, lovely, horribly immoral place. Your kids will immediately ask you, wait, we just connected with that guy. What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And the questions are always narrative questions. We are that character. What should we do? Where do we go? How do we live? That's why you give them the right stories. And you can't pretend like they're not being fed the wrong stories all the time. Every time they turn on the television and watch another sitcom, it's going to introduce gender issues, homosexual issues, everything it can possibly introduce, and it's going to make them connect with the character, then that character is going to behave in a certain way in regard to those issues, and they're going to start to have that pattern. They're going to want to sympathize with that. But that's the cool guy. That's Byron. I thought you told me that Byron was awesome. I thought he wrote good poems. And you just do it again with contemporary art. You have got to really, really ingrain this stuff, the right loyalties, the right instincts as characters. You have to ingrain those things in your students. Get them in there, because other people are trying to ingrain other things. They're trying to ingrain other grooves, other narrative grooves, other comfort zones. They're trying to establish those things so that kids won't dislike certain behaviors, will be okay with living next to certain behaviors, and even, you know, accepting them into their own lives. They're actively pushing one direction, we are actively pushing another. You want their instincts to be in place. Instincts to be in place. So when they see a certain type of girl, there's a knee-jerk reaction that is in accordance with the behavior of many, many noble characters before them. They know what to do. They know what to do. And not because they had it written on a whiteboard, not because they circled C on a multiple choice test, but because they vicariously lived it repeatedly. They've been here before. They know that's hot. They don't want to touch it. It's like they've seen characters get burned. They felt that burn. They felt that separation. They felt the reunion after. That's what you want for your students. And it means first you have to have it for yourself. Early on, obviously, the discernment and the judgments are entirely yours. This is the story we're going to read. This is the story we're not going to read. I'm going to make you read this one, but then I'm not going to really tell you the whole story. We're going to do this Bible story, but we're not going to get into it. We're going to hop right over. Why? Well, because parents will call me angry. That's why. If you're going to push the limits in subject matter that's introduced in the classroom, just make sure it's in Scripture. There's plenty there. That's your strongest position. You don't need to rush into it. It's like early on with little kids, it's an issue of, does this person fuss? Are they complaining? Are they selfish? It's like there's a lot of those things that can be sorted out. You don't need to get into the complications of Anna Karenina when they're in third grade. Please, don't do it. Work with those beginning situations, lying, selfishness, pride, and so on, and then move on. As the kids grow, their loves and loyalties should be well-fed and intact. They should realize, they should have the same emotional reaction when they watch a certain film that asks them to accept a certain kind of behavior. They should have the same emotional reaction as if this film was asking them to go ahead and just curse their mother. It's like, just go ahead, do it. Kick your grandma on the head. They should have that kind of affection, that kind of loyalty, that kind of connectivity to the truth, to nobility, to righteousness, and so on. So that's not like, well, that just looks really cool. They should immediately connect it to what they'd have to be abandoning, those things that they truly love. Your students must learn to hate. And that's, I'd put, as I was talking about in my workshop yesterday, I'd stick that in the dialectic phase. It's like, little kids, just give them those wonderful, wholesome, comfort food stories. Give them lots of great stories. Lots of things to love, things to love, things to love. And then you give them, in the dialectic phase, you give them pointy objects. You let them run with scissors. You let them do more dangerous things, engage with things that they are now allowed to hate. And don't mistake love and hate for opposites, incidentally. They really aren't. There can be things that you love which really make you hate chapter 3, because everything else is wonderful, and this is a betrayal of this wonderful thing. I hate this, and I still like the book overall. They should be able to distinguish with a scalpel, not just dismiss, not just boycott and throw things away. Finally, the training wheels come off whether you want them to or not. Bubble boy leaves the house. Private school girl leaves whether or not she really wants to be Avril Lavigne when she grows up. That's what's going to happen. They're going to leave. The training wheels are coming off. You can't keep them on. And they have to, as a result of this, they have to have learned to tell, and in telling, to live the story for themselves. And that is ultimately the goal for all of us. Thank you very much.